This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Qul inna salati wa nusuki wa mahyaya wa mamati lillahi rabbil alameen la sharika lah wa bithalika umirtu wa ana
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things. And no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran warning again that the success of the upcoming Vienna negotiations is tied to the U.S. moving first to remove all sanctions. The emergence of a potentially more infectious COVID variant in South Africa is causing global concerns, already hitting Asian markets and oil prices. And Sudanese turn out by the thousands in several cities against a power-sharing deal between the military and civilian leadership. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumi Shah Ahmadi, and these are top stories this hour. Now, Iran warns the upcoming Vienna talks will fail unless the U.S. agrees to scrap all anti-Tehran sanctions first. Deputy Foreign Minister Ali Bagheri-Kani stressed that any progress in the talks depends on sanctions removal and a guarantee that a future U.S. administration would not abandon the deal again. The Iranian official made the comments during an interview with the British Daily Independent. Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal are set to start a new round of talks in the Austrian capital on November 29th. The negotiations are aimed at removing anti-Tehran measures. Former U.S. President Donald Trump pulled his country out of the U.N. Security Council-endorsed nuclear deal in 2018 and reimposed sanctions on Tehran.
Representative at the International Atomic Energy Agency addresses a virtual session of the IAEA's Board of Governors. Mohammad Reza Khaibi says the Islamic Republic's first priority at the upcoming talks to revive the nuclear deal known as the JCPOA will be the effective and verifiable removal of U.S. sanctions without any further delay and any preconditions.
The principal position of the new government of the Islamic Republic of Iran is that the first priority and issue that should be considered seriously into consideration is removal of all illegal sanctions imposed against Iran after the withdrawal of the U.S. from the deal.
Qaibi said the U.S. needs to address concerns arising from its 2018 withdrawal from the agreement, the least of which which is how its possible future adherence can be relied upon. Iran has also criticized European states for requesting that Tehran implement its commitments under the deal, saying that until sanctions are not removed, it's not reasonable to expect more forbearance from the country. During the previous rounds of talks on reviving the JCPOA, Iran made it clear it wanted all U.S. sanctions, including additional ones imposed under the previous administration of Donald Trump, to be removed. Up until now, Tehran says, the administration of Joe Biden has not only failed to mitigate the U.S. maximum pressure policy, but has actually exacerbated it. Delegates from Iran, the three European states of Britain, France, Germany, plus Russia and China, are expected to resume negotiations on Monday here at Vienna's Hotel Coburg, the same venue where talks to reach the nuclear agreement concluded more than 6 years ago. Homa Lezgi, Vienna.
Moving on, the United States has threatened to confront Iran at the International Atomic Energy Agency, accusing Tehran of not cooperating with the new UN nuclear watchdog. The U.S. statement came during a meeting of the IAEA's Board of Governors. It said, quote, Iran's non-cooperation is, if it is not remedied immediately, the board will have no choice but to reconvene an extraordinary session to address the crisis. It added that such a meeting could take place by the end of the year. Washington said it was referring especially to reinstalling surveillance cameras at the Karaj site near Tehran, where the IAEA has no access for 7 months. The facility came under a sabotage attack in June, which Iran blames on Israel. Tehran says the site is under security investigation and therefore off limits to inspection. Global stocks are tumbling down after the detection of a new coronavirus variant in South Africa. In Asia, Japan's Nikkei is down by a staggering 3%. The Hang Seng Index and the Hong Kong China Enterprises Index have each shed 2.1%. In the U.S., the S&P 500 futures are down 1%. Oil prices are also experiencing a shock, with U.S. crude oil futures falling 2.7%. The drop comes in reaction to South African scientists announcing a new COVID variant with many mutations just a day earlier. They are blaming the new variant for the rapid growth in infections. The United Kingdom is banning travel from several African countries as a precaution. The World Health Organization will meet later on Friday to discuss the new strain. And Yemen's prime minister has paid honor to Press TV for its major role in supporting the impoverished nation of Yemen since the beginning of the Saudi-led war on the country in March 2015. Our correspondent in Sana'a, Abdulatifa Washali, has more.
In the Yemeni capital Sana'a, Yemen's Prime Minister Abdulaziz bin Habtour honored the Press TV for its prominent role in standing by the Yemeni people and exposing the crimes of the Saudi-led coalition since the beginning of the war.
I would like to thank Press TV and its crew for standing by the Yemeni people in the face of the war imposed on us. Press TV reveals the truth about the war that has taken place between the axis of resistance and the U.S. proxies in the region. Sana'a is just one of the front lines of this confrontation. We greatly appreciate every effort made by satellite channels that honestly expose the crimes of the Saudi-led coalition and reveal the suffering of Yemenis to the world amid the continuing war and siege imposed by Saudi Arabia.
Participants said the Press TV has always been supporting the Yemeni people and its major role is clear through its continuing existence in the field to keep pace with the advancements of the Yemeni army and the Saudi violations against Yemenis.
Press TV is one of the leading channels that serves as a role model for free media and contributes to the resistance of the Yemeni people. This channel has had a prominent impact on Yemenis by keeping pace with every event, whether the victories of the Yemeni army or the crimes of the Saudi-led coalition. So Press TV deserves to be honored and appreciated by the Prime Minister.
Since the beginning of 2015, Yemenis have been suffering under war and siege imposed by Saudi Arabia. The United Nations describes Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian crisis and says millions of Yemenis, including children, are on the brink of famine.
Observers say Saudi Arabia has used thousands of media outlets to spread its propaganda and mislead the free people of the world about its war crimes in Yemen. Therefore, as observers say, the resistance media outlets should stand together against the Saudi-led coalition media war. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Protesters have hit the streets of several Sudanese cities to denounce the recent deal between the military and Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok after last month's coup in the country. The protesters slammed Sunday's deal that reinstated Hamdok as betrayal. They called it cover-up for the military takeover of their country. Last month, the military dissolved the transitional government and detained cabinet members, including the prime minister, despite a 2019 power-sharing deal with civilian leaders. Under the new deal, Hamdok has been allowed to lead a government of technocrats together with the military during a transition period. The two sides have also agreed to hold elections by July 2023. But pro-democracy activists are opposed to any deal with the military, citing its deadly crackdown. More than 40 protesters have been killed since October 25th. Local commentator Edward Corrigan says the deal is a couple of steps forward, but it is not something that the people wanted in Sudan following the coup.
Reinstating the prime minister, releasing all political prisoners, and are supposedly still working under the context of the agreement to bring about the transition for democracy in a couple of years. So on one hand, it's a good deal. On the other hand, it still shows that the military is really pretty much in control, but I think that that's a reflection of the reality in Sudan and the 15 groups that can mobilize and put people in the streets. That's not the same thing as confronting the army in a full-scale battle and overturning it. So it's a problem. I think on one hand, it's a couple steps forward, but on the other hand, the military is still very much in control. But I think that's the reality.
A third day of unrest in the Solomon Islands with Prime Minister Hanau accusing foreign countries of triggering the protests. Demonstrators are calling for the Prime Minister to step down. They have come out burning buildings and looting businesses in defiance of government lockdowns. The tensions are linked to the government's decision 2 years ago to cut diplomatic ties with Taiwan and establish relations with China. The Prime Minister says certain foreign states are stoking anger because they don't want the Solomon Islands to have ties with China. Australia has sent over hundreds of police officers to help quell the unrest. The small South Pacific island country has been dealing with ethnic and political tensions for decades. And the arrest of a prominent human rights activist in Indian administered Kashmir continues to draw condemnations inside and outside of the region. Poonam Parvez was arrested by India over what is called a criminal conspiracy and illegal money transfer for terror activities. Correspondent Shana Butt reports.
India's top anti-terror investigation agency has arrested Kashmir-based human rights defender Khurram Parvez under the terror law, UAPA, or Unlawful Activities Prevention Act. Following his arrest, global rights bodies and activists, including the United Nations Special Rapporteur, have strongly condemned his arrest.
The state is using its machinery to arrest innocent people, and the people who give dissent or document anything, the violations done by the forces in Jammu and Kashmir.
The 42-year-old Khurram Parvez formed the Jammu and Kashmir Coalition of Civil Society along with other activists in 2000. He is the chairman of the Asian Federation Against Involuntary Disappearances. Parvez, JKCCS has highlighted human rights abuses by Indian forces in Indian-administered Kashmir for the past 20 years. Back in 2016, Parvez was barred from traveling to Switzerland, where he was supposed to attend a session of the United Nations Human Rights Council. A day later, was booked under the PSA, or Public Safety Act, which allows detention for a year without trial, and was released after 76 days of imprisonment. Since New Delhi's grabbed Kashmir's special status in August 2019, at least 2,300 people have been arrested under the UAPA in Muslim-majority Kashmir. Sources say almost half of them continue to be jailed.
UAPA Unlawful Activities Act, Prevention Act, has been used as a tool to quell the voices of the common masses, and it is being invoked against all the people who even speak about dissent or try to criticize the establishment.
Analysts say the situation in Indian-administered Kashmir has slipped from bad to worse after the Narendra Modi-led Indian government stripped Kashmir's limited autonomy and split the region into two union territories in 2019.
With the growing public demand for Khurram Parvez's release, analysts say by such arrest, India is sparking further criticism for its ruling Bharatiya Janata Party's policies and ideology. Shahana Bhatt, Indian-administered Kashmir.
Now, the controversial decision by the UK government to brand all of Hamas, including its political wing, as a terrorist organization has been passed through Parliament. The bill received no challenge, meaning that a vote was not needed for the law to be passed. Robert Carter covered the story.
The UK government's plan to include Palestinian group Hamas's political wing on the terrorism list has been successful after the House of Lords approved the bill, which members of Parliament failed to challenge. MPs have to object to a motion in order for it to be put to a vote. Not a single member decided to do so.
The amendment to the Terrorism Act 2000 was successfully passed through Parliament on Wednesday afternoon following a debate. It's now been moved to the House of Lords for further approval. Once passed there today, the law will officially come into force on Friday, the 26th of November.
Although there were no objections to the bill, serious concern over the Palestinians' right to resist did cause a stir during the debate.
But we need to be careful here, because people do have a right to resist. And we need to understand this is an occupied people that we are talking about. But did I correctly hear him when he was talking about the indiscriminate Hamas attacks that they send into Israel? That he seemed to be saying the only problem with them is that they weren't more accurately targeted to kill certain Israelis.
Away from Parliament, concern surrounds how the law change could affect humanitarian efforts to the besieged Gaza Strip.
And I do think you are right to warn of the dangers which we have already experienced for charitable or humanitarian endeavours in this country. Banks will close and have closed bank accounts of those supporting Palestinians, even though they are purely humanitarian, not political in any way whatsoever. What is often forgotten is that Hamas is an elected government, and people may not like their elected government. I don't particularly like the one we've got in the UK, but Hamas is the elected government.
The Palestinian mission to London released a statement on the 19th saying the UK was being retrograde and one-sided. Despite these comments, the UK claims to remain faithful to the so-called two-state solution. Robert Carter, Press TV, London.
And with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News.
Of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
The Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change, and that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
international community to force Tel Aviv into dismantling its apartheid regime. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written jointly by Ramzi Barod and Romana Rubeo, journalist. This article is titled Raids, Arrests, and Death Threats: Israeli Regime's Strategy of Silencing Human Rights Defenders. Stay tuned for the first part of this article, please. On October 21st, Israeli regime war minister Benny Gantz announced the issuance of a military order designating six prominent Palestinian human rights groups as terrorist organizations. Gantz claimed that they are secretly linked to the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, PFLP, a socialist political group that the Israeli regime considers a terrorist organization. The Palestinian organization included in the Israeli regime order are Avamir, Prisoner Support and Human Rights, Al-Haq, the Bison Center for Research and Development, Defense for Children Palestine, Union of Agricultural Work Committees, UAWC, and the Union of Palestinian Women's Committees. Considering the significance of these organizations in Palestine and their global networks among like-minded civil society organizations, the Israeli regime decision provoked a public outcry. One of the many statements of the condemnation was a joint statement by rights groups, Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, HRW, in which they call Gantz's move an appalling and unjust decision, which represents an attack by the Israeli regime on the international human rights movement. Amnesty International and HRW, which have documented Israeli human rights violations of Palestinians for many years, fully understand that the terrorist designation is consistent with a long trajectory of such unlawful moves. For decades, Israeli regime authorities have systematically sought to muzzle human rights monitoring and punish those who criticize its repressive rule over Palestinians. While staff members of organizations have faced deportation and travel bans, Palestinian human rights defenders have always borne the brunt of the repression. This decision is an alarming escalation that threatens to shut down the work of Palestine's most prominent civil society organizations. Equally important in the world's leading rights group's statement is that it did not fail to highlight that the decades-long failure of the international community to challenge grave Israeli human rights abuses and impose meaningful consequences for them has emboldened Israeli regime authorities to act in this brazen manner. True to form, the international community did react to Gantz's decision, albeit it was the kind of ineffectual reaction which persisted in the realm of rhetoric that is rarely followed by substantive action. Joint statement by UN experts called the Israeli regime decision a frontal attack on the Palestinian human rights movement and on human rights everywhere. Michelle Bachelet, United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, criticized the arbitrary decision by the Zionist regime and warned of the far-reaching consequences as a result in terms of work, funding, and support for the targeted organizations. Many governments around the world also condemned the Israeli regime move and echoed the sentiment conveyed by UN experts. Even the United States expressed its concern, though, using the same
typically cautious and non-committal language. U.S. State Department spokesman Ned Price told reporters on October 23rd in Washington that his country believes respect for human rights, fundamental freedoms, and a strong civil society are critically important to responsible and responsive governance. Instead of an outright condemnation, however, Price said that the United States will be engaging Israeli partners for more information regarding the basis for these designations, unquote. However, like other governments, and certainly unlike Amnesty International and HRW, Price made no link between the Israeli regime decision of October 21st and numerous other past practices targeting human rights and civil society groups in Palestine, and more recently, in the occupied territories as well. Also worth noting is that the supposed link between such organizations and the socialist PFLP is not new. In December 2012, the Israeli regime army raided the headquarters of Adamir in Ramallah, confiscating laptops and a video camera. The offices of the Union of Palestinian Women Committees were also raided by the Zionist regime occupation forces on the same day. The organization is one of the six now designated by the Zionist regime as terrorist. In September 2019, Adamir's offices were raided once again. The Israeli regime military raid at the time, however, did not generate as much attention or outrage, despite the accompanying violence, let alone the blatant violation of human rights. Then, Al-Haq, also one of the other six effectively banned Palestinian groups, issued a statement warning that the private property of human rights organizations in occupied territories is especially protected under Article 46 of the Hague Regulations. Expectedly, such legal constraints mattered little to the Zionist regime. Al-Haq's staff have faced many restrictions throughout the years. Shawan Jabari, the general director of Al-Haq, has been banned from travel on various occasions starting in 2006. In March 2009, Jabari was prevented by the Zionist regime from traveling to the Netherlands to receive an award on behalf of his organization. Again, in November 2011, this time, Jabarin was now allowed to travel to Denmark. The Zionist regime obstacles began taking even more sinister turns when, in March 2016, Jabarin began receiving death threats over the phone. These anonymous calls began arriving in the context of increasing harassment of Al-Haq and its members. Amid their recent work at the International Criminal Court, ICC, seeking justice for human rights violations being committed in the occupied Palestinian territories, the Frontline Defenders website reported. Defense for Children International Palestine in July and again August 2021, Israeli regime forces raided Defense for Children International Palestine, DCIP offices in Al-Bira in the occupied West Bank. They seized computers, hard drives, and other material, alleging a link between the organization and the PFLP. This allegation had already been advanced in 2018 when UK lawyers for the Israeli regime UKLFI persuaded Citibank and the Arab Bank, PLC, to stop providing banking services to DCIP, providing what they defined as evidence of the close ties to PFLP. While it is true that the recent Israeli regime measures against Palestinian NGOs are a continuation of an old policy, there are fundamental differences between the growing perception of the fake regime of Israel now as an apartheid regime and the misconstrued perception of the past. even international entities and groups that are yet to brand the Israeli regime as an apartheid regime are becoming familiar with the Israeli regime's undemocratic nature.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Midstream.
Yemenis wrongfully allied with the U.S.-Saudi aggression in the south now fear a repetition of the Afghanistan scenario in their areas. They are closely watching how during the past week, Saudi Arabia has evacuated most of the military camps it occupied in the southern governorates. In parallel, it is now rare to find Emirati forces in many southern regions since the Emirati forces had previously begun a massive evacuation of their own forces after enduring a series of military blows by the Yemeni armed forces. The U.S.-Saudi-UAE coalition of aggression's problem now is no longer about what is happening in Ma'rib. Everyone, without exception, is proceeding as if the city has already fallen. Ma'rib is a done deal, liberated and on the road to recovery. What is actually undergoing these days are negotiations between the Sana'a government and a number of tribes from the people of the Valley District adjacent to Ma'rib from the southeastern side, in addition to the city itself, amid a massive exodus of the stranger mercenaries who feel unwelcomed by the city's residents. Discussions focus on a single option: spare the city blood and destruction and repeat the experience of Al-Hazm, the capital of Al-Jawf, in which the tribes agreed to a settlement that ended up handing it over to the leadership of the Yemeni armed resistance without battles. The Saudis have entered a new phase of fatigue and frustration. All the forces and tribes that they have been funding and arming over the past 6 months have not provided any remedy to stop the Ansarullah offensive. Even when the British forces succeeded in modifying the battle plan by instigating clashes on the side of Al-Shabwa and Al-Dalia,
The result was that Ansarullah eased its attack on Ma'rib and directed its forces towards the south, achieving progress beyond what was intended. This allowed Ansarullah for the first time in years to return to southern regions as they threw a settlement with the local tribes there. The additional support the Saudis got from the Americans did not work. Neither did the hastily brought in F-16 squadron succeeded in repelling the ground attacks, nor the network of drones deployed around the clock succeeded in stopping the Yemeni military strikes, nor did all the indiscriminate bombing raids prevent the forces from advancing. What comes next, you may ask? All military and security eavesdropping stations operating in the Red Sea and around Yemen learned that the Ansarullah command directed the operations room to prepare a quick plan aimed at regaining the Strait of Bab al-Mandab immediately after the completion of the Ma'rib battle. Special forces have already begun taking over the mountains surrounding Hudaydah, aiming all the way to Mukha and Bab al-Mandab. Phones are ringing off the hook across the Arab world and beyond in paranoia of the situation. It seems that next month will be a vital one in completing the full liberation of Yemen. Welcome to the Middle East Stream, I'm Marwa Osman. In Yemen are on the Ma'rib battle. In recent days, new developments have been taking place in the port city of Hudaydah, increasingly changing the battleground circumstances in favor of the Yemeni armed forces. After a sudden retreat of the UAE-backed forces from Hudaydah in western Yemen, Ansarullah movement took control of major parts of the strategic province. The withdrawal process carried out by militias loyal to Saudi Emirati alliance from large areas of the western coast opens the door to dramatic developments in other areas, especially in Shabwa Governorate, which appears to be the next destination for the power struggle, with Saudi Arabia racing to consolidate its cards there, hoping maybe to reap future gains that might compensate its expected loss in Ma'rib. To discuss this issue with us from Brussels is Brett Jonkers, member of the Yemen Solidarity Council. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Brett, now hundreds of Yemenis in the city of Hudaydah expressed their happiness over the withdrawal of the UAE occupation forces and the reopening of the Kilo 16 road, as the city has been under siege for almost 3 years now. How do you assess the importance of this development in Hudaydah in parallel to what was going on in Ma'rib?
Well, I think there is absolutely no way to overstate just how important this really is. The Kilo 16 road, as you mentioned, is indeed a very important connection route between Hudaydah and the Yemeni hinterland. In fact, it is probably the most important highway, the most important route between the port city of Hudaydah, which is the most important, you know, port city in the free parts of Yemen, and the capital of Sana'a. So there are millions and millions of people who live in the liberated and the free parts of Yemen, in the north and in the west of Yemen, who are, for a major part, unfortunately at this point, dependent on aid and on transportation that comes in from the coastline that they're holding near the port city of Hudaydah. And especially when you realize that now, finally, under international pressure, there have been slowly some developments in the fact that fuel shipments and also food shipments and international humanitarian aid has finally been seeping through the Saudi blockade into the city of Hudaydah. So when you take those things into account, when you have the city of Hudaydah slowly but surely starting to receive finally these life-saving necessary shipments that are necessary for the survival of millions of people who have been living under blockade and under war for nearly 7 years now, when you take that into account and combine it with the final reopening of this route that has been blocked for the past 3 years, that will allow, hopefully, unhindered and unlimited transportation of the goods that come in from Hudaydah to the very densely populated areas of Sana'a and its surroundings. This is a matter of life and death for countless of millions of Yemenis that are relying on this. We're talking fuel, we're talking food, we're talking medicines, and we're also talking in a more strategic military aspect, the liberation and the security of the city of Hudaydah and of several areas in the western coast. For example, the city of Al-Duraimi, which has been under constant threat of war and conflict for years now. So when you see that...
That's really important, but there's something that most observers are claiming, which I don't really agree with, but here's what they're saying. They're saying that
This retreat from Hudaydah is related to an agreement with Sana'a to make concessions to Ansarullah in exchange for retreating from the siege of Ma'rib or Taaz. However, if this was a concession, why did Saudi Arabia bomb Yemen 65 airstrikes, Mr. Breck, in less than 24 hours last week, just after the liberation of Hudaydah?
Yes, exactly. Like I think you already basically mentioned what the problem is with this line of reasoning that they're using. Basically, what the Saudis are doing is they're trying to cover up in the media, trying to cover up their failures. This is one line that they're using. I've also read other lines in which they say, oh, we're just retreating from Hudaydah because that is what the Stockholm Agreement said, that we should redeploy and we should desist from conflict because Hudaydah is a ceasefire zone, which of course is also ludicrous because the ceasefire was signed years ago, and so far, for all those years, the Saudis have never bothered to adhere to the principles of the ceasefire. So why do they suddenly do so now? I think the real reason is twofold, and it's nothing to do with a secret agreement with Ansarullah, with the National Salvation Government. It has nothing to do with the fact that they finally woke up and realized that they should probably keep to a ceasefire agreement that they literally signed. But in reality, what it has to do with is two things. That is, one, they know that their position is militarily untenable on the West Coast, and two, that they need every single man they can get in order to try to defend peace at least in the center of the country, like Ma'rib and Taiz. And that is exactly what they're trying to do now. They are withdrawing from the West Coast, from areas that they consider maybe not strategically too important and untenable militarily, and trying to redeploy the Saudi, Emirati, and mercenary forces in Ma'rib, in Taiz,
well,
in order to...
I doubt that would actually play off to their benefit, but in retaliation to those Saudi airstrikes, we did see Ansarullah target the King Abdullah Airport and four Aramco refineries in the city of Jeddah, in addition to the King Khalid base in the capital Riyadh and Abha International Airport as well. That took place as Ansarullah were also advancing in Shabwa, which by the way was made way by the UAE by turning the fire to Shabwa, and Hudaydah, aiming also now to retain the Strait of Bab al-Mandab. Now obviously Mohammed bin Salman can do nothing about it anymore, but will this push maybe the U.S. or maybe the British forces to take matters into their own hands and maybe rather than risk lose such a vital waterway like Bab al-Mandab?
I think that is definitely something that is being negotiated and discussed about. This is also why there has been this recent mass sale of military equipment again to Saudi Arabia by this time Joe Biden administration. And that is why there is still a push by war hawks and by the neoconservatives and Zionists in the United States to keep supporting Saudi Arabia, or even to take a very active military role in this. The other side of the story, however, is that there is a growing, let's say, like war fatigue in terms of Yemen in particular, not in general, because the United States will unfortunately, I believe, never be sick of war completely. But lately, recently, we've seen 30 senators, I believe, that already now in the Senate itself have called for a complete and total, basically, military boycott of Saudi Arabia as long as this war continues. And this is not necessarily because the people are pacifists, but because they see that this is a conflict that they most likely cannot win. It has been dragging on for nearly 7 years now, and the United States has bigger fish to fry nowadays. The United States is still busy with a pivot to Asia, the pivot to China, trying to contain the rise of China. And so that's why they also withdrew from Afghanistan recently. So I believe that fortunately, all these things kept in consideration, that the United States will eventually have no other recourse but to dial back on the support of Saudi, that they give to Saudi Arabia, which will hopefully then also mean the total end of the Saudi invasion and the failure of the attack against Yemen.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Mr. Brett Jonkers, member of the Yemen Solidarity Council, for joining us to talk about the recent developments in Yemen, which most definitely will show even further development before the end of this year. Thank you for being with us. Now, please stay tuned, because next we will talk about how the UK will ban Hamas.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Now, years after Britain banned the military wing of Hamas, the Qassam Brigades, British Home Secretary Priti Patel announced her government's intention to include the movement itself among terrorist organizations. This week, the British Parliament will vote on amendments to the anti-terrorism laws to include Hamas. The British Home Secretary, who is used to spending her vacations in Zionist Israel, said that if this classification is adopted, whoever belongs to or promotes Hamas will be punished with imprisonment for a term that can reach up to 14 years under the provisions of the British Anti-Terrorism Act. I'm not even slightly surprised here. UK to ban Hamas resistance in this following report.
Days after the 104th anniversary of the infamous Balfour Declaration, the British Home Secretary Priti Patel announced her country's intention to classify Hamas in all its political and military forms as a terrorist organization, which the Zionist occupation celebrated, while Hamas described it as a British continuation of the old animosity. This week, the British Parliament will vote on amendments to the anti-terrorism laws to include Hamas. Supporting the movement with words, raising its flags, and meeting its activists will be considered, quote, illegal activities, end quote. In this context, Patel said that it is not possible to differentiate between the political and military wings of Hamas, claiming that the decision is based on widespread information that indicates that the movement has carried out, quote, terrorist activities, end quote. Patel even accused Hamas of anti-Semitism, considering the latest measure against it important for the safety of the Jewish community in Britain. I still fail to understand how an actual Semite can be branded as an anti-Semite, but let's move on. It took literally no time between Britain announcing this decision and the Zionist occupation celebrating it. Zionist Prime Minister Naftali Bennett thanked the United Kingdom, saying that there was no difference between the political and military wings of Hamas, adding the difference lies only in uniforms. Hamas is a radical Islamic organization that targets, quote, innocent Israelis and seeks to destroy Israel, end quote. Mind you, that came from the leader of a group of genocidal maniacs who were brought in by the Brits, wiped the native Palestinians off the face of their homeland, stole their homes and property, and pursued to kill and incarcerate anyone who dares to say no. While Bennett attributed the decision to his friendship with British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, Israeli Foreign Minister Yair Lapid considered London's move as one of the fruits of his ministry's efforts. Meanwhile, Israel's Channel 12 reported that the Shin Bet provided a lot of materials and information that helped their foreign ministry deal with the British. The channel added that the Shin Bet also assisted in briefings with the decision makers in Britain to validate this new law. So yes, we completely believe that this was a British decision, not an Israeli-induced one, through the many political channels controlled by Tel Aviv, like none other than the Home Secretary herself. Since if it slipped your mind, we're here to remind you that Priti Patel was forced to step down as International Development Secretary back in 2017 because she failed to candid with her Prime Minister about 14 unofficial meetings with Israeli ministers, business people, and senior lobbyists while on, quote, family vacation, end quote, in Zionist Israel. Priti Patel's scandal, along with her current efforts solely in favor of Israel, speaks volume about the dark operations of the UK's powerful Israeli lobby. While the UK is regarded as one of Israel's most fervent supporters in Europe, the work of the likes of Patel should be a cause for public indignation. I fail to fathom how any nation would gleefully allow other foreign entities to enjoy such unabashed, high-level political support, while said foreign entity is nothing more than a force of occupation living on genocide since 1948.
To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Ehsan Ataya, leader of the Islamic Jihad in Lebanon and the Palestine coordinator of the Global Gathering in Support of the Choice of Resistance. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Ataya, for being us. Now, according to the UK Minister of Interior, this classification is actually adopted. Whoever belongs to or promotes Hamas will be punished with imprisonment for a term that can reach up to 14 years under the provisions of the so-called British Anti-Terrorism Act. What are the implications of such a decision if it passes in Parliament?
It's an attempt by Britain, the founding and leading country which established the Zionist project in our region in 1948. It's an attempt to save their project after it sank into a great quagmire following the Battle of Sayf al-Quds. It's also an attempt to pressure the Hamas government to pass a so-called economic peace project or a long truce with the occupation entity. They seek to empty Gaza from its resistance and military content, and this resistance is an attempt to neutralize Gaza, a strip that threatens the Zionist entity in its presence on the path of liberating Palestine. Such a decision is not really a surprise coming from colonial power like Britain. However, this ban will be a test for the international community and for the laws and regulations of the United Nations. If it passes through UK Parliament this week, then it means Britain is breaking international law. Article 51 of the UN Charter gives the right to individuals and groups to resist any occupation and to use all means available to defend themselves, their property, and their nation. However, if this ban is approved, then it will not affect the work and power of the resistance. As long as there is an occupation in Palestine, there will always be a resistance to fight. Palestinians have every right to fight back, especially in Gaza, the biggest open-air prison in the world.
Well, Ms. Ataya, no sooner had Britain announced this approach, if you will, until the occupying powers celebrated it. And the Prime Minister, Naftali Bennett, thanked the United Kingdom, saying that there was no difference between the political and the military wing of Hamas. Why does it seem that they are looking for some sort of a green light for Israel to commit more massacres in Gaza? What do you think, as part of the Islamic Jihad, will this affect you as well as a resistance movement?
This classification does not diminish the importance of the resistance facing the Zionist project and the American project that greatly supports Zionism in the whole region. Therefore, by taking such a decision, we cannot say that Britain is giving a green light to the Zionist entity to commit more massacres, because the Zionist entity is committing massacres on a daily basis in Palestine. Israel commits violations on a daily basis and attacks the Palestinian people. It attacks residents of Al-Quds and their neighborhoods. It also attacks the Palestinians of the 1948 territories. It also violates the rights of prisoners and defenseless detainees from any possibility of facing this aggression except through their empty stomachs, through brave hunger strikes. Therefore, this British support, which gives an additional cover for the Zionist entity to perpetrate all these types of massacres, it also giving it a green light to continue this aggressive behavior against the Palestinian people in order to save their entity from the reality and the abyss in which it fell, especially after its military system was struck hard in the Battle of Sayf al-Quds. This battle deprived the Iron Dome of its effectiveness, as well as striking Israel's security prestige after the Freedom Tunnel operation, as well as yesterday's Al-Quds operation, which constituted an additional blow to the security system of the Zionist entity. This proves that the Palestinian people adhere to their resistance until the liberation of all of Palestine from the hands of the occupation and the liberation of the Palestinian people and the entire region from these Zionist aggressions, starting from occupied Palestine to include the entire surrounding region that is harmed by the existence of this entity. Unfortunately, there are some official Arab regimes who chose to collude with this dangerous Zionist American project in order to exert more pressure on the Palestinian people and their entire resistance axis.
Well,
Mr. Ataya, Hamas did respond to this announcement. We all heard them saying that this decision, if implemented, is actually considered a great political, moral, ethical, and legal sin committed by Britain, in addition to its first sin, which is actually establishing the Zionist entity by signing the illegal Balfour Declaration. situation. But if Israel were really in control of the situation in occupied Palestine, it wouldn't continually seek whitewashing from Western powers. What does that tell you about the Zionist situation inside occupied Palestine?
Frankly, Britain does not care about any moral considerations with its behavior in support of the Zionist project in our region, nor does it pay attention to all the objections directed to it since the Balfour Declaration until this day. Britain is still pursuing this approach in support of the Zionist entity in order to complete its hegemony over the whole region and not only over Palestine. From here, we can say that Britain's view, and that of the West in general, for this entity is a view that considers Israel the only guarantee for their domination over the Arab and Islamic world. Therefore, they give priority to supporting this entity, mainly because this entity was shaken under the numerous strikes of the resistance, starting with its exit from South Lebanon under the strikes of the Lebanese resistance, as well as its exit from Gaza under the strikes of the resistance, and the many confrontations that the occupation faced in Gaza when hit with the resistance missiles, as well as the heroic operations that are being carried out inside occupied Palestine, whether in Al-Quds or in 1948 territories or in the West Bank. Therefore, this Zionist entity, whose status has been destabilized and faces a real danger to its existence in this period, we see Britain today at the forefront of direct support for this entity, stepping on all human values.